Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
The Kitsap Forest Theater is a natural outdoor amphitheater just outside of Bremerton, Washington. It's run by the Mountaineers. We are Mountaineers players. And it's been here for 93 years now. We're on a 640-acre forest preserve. And we are about to enter the trail that leads down to the theater.
All right, let's go.
By the way, this is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, in for Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm talking to Todd Herrick near a stand of tall evergreens. Todd is an actor. He recently got roped into this because of his daughters, Jasmine and Eliana. They love the stage. And it turns out that Todd is a natural. He's playing the Tin Man in the Kitsap Forest Theater's upcoming production of The Wizard of Oz. Jasmine is Dorothy, and Eliana has the role of the Coronor. This is the family's sixth year performing at one of the oldest outdoor theaters in the country. It's just outside of Bremerton.
So we just came down a really long trail, and we're now deep in the woods. And what is before us here?
All right. So as you said, we come down it's about a quarter mile trail. It's through what I would say is almost is an old growth forest now. This was 100 years ago, this was all rhododendron. It had been logged and burned, and there were really very few trees. There were some large ones, but it was all coated in rhododendron, and that's why people first began coming here, because the rhododendrons were spectacular, and people would come from all over the place. And so some of the people who were mountaineers and were coming here met a family that had homesteaded here, became friends with them, and began to come and stay with them every year, and they began to do little shows, performances, and concerts. And eventually that developed into an annual theatrical production. And that was 93 years ago. And so they've been doing shows here continuously, except a couple of years during World War II, they couldn't do them. And over the time, this forest has grown up. And so now we've come down this trail through this forest, and we are here at the Natural Amphitheater. It's really surrounded by Douglas fir and red cedar and big leaf maple. There are rhododendrons on the stage. The stage itself is dirt. So the entire thing is really, it really is a stage that blends very naturally right into the forest.
What about this location just excites you and blows your mind?
Well, not to be trite, but you know, one of the slogans of the place is that it's theater in a magical place. And I feel that every time we come here. There's the sound of the spring. There's the way that the performance space just naturally flows into an old growth forest that is the epitome of what I think of as the Pacific Northwest. And so anybody that comes here to see a show, that's the thing that blows everybody away. That, wow, I really didn't expect it to be so part of nature.
It's not just the visual beauty. Could you describe what we're smelling?
Ah, sure. You've got cedar, you've got fir, you've got the rhododendrons, but mostly it's cedar and fir. And you're right, it's not just what you see, it's the sound. Right now there's songbirds, we have eagles, we have owls, there's the rush of the creek, the wind in the trees. Oh, and this is amazing. It'll impact the show. Sometimes nature will do the most amazing things. So for instance, when we were doing Fiddler on the Roof and he started to sing Havala, which is this tender song to his daughter, and it just started to rain just lightly. And when the song was done, it stopped. When we did Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's a moment in which the lion is killed, and he's killed and he's lying on this altar, and a beam of sunlight broke through the clouds and just shone right on him. We did The Secret Garden here. And one of the things that happens in the story is that the girl is led to the garden by this bird. And at the moment the bird is supposed to start talking to, a bird started singing. So he landed on a tree and started singing. So things like that, you can't predict, but you walk away with those moments realizing you've seen something visceral that is unique and couldn't happen anywhere else, and that you're going to carry with you the rest of your life. That's what we get here.
Our theme this week on Sound Effect is Into the Woods. We'll learn how the forest is an antidote for people who are becoming sick from too much of the digital world. We'll hear how living off the land in the wilderness gave one young man the ability to move through life with confidence. And we'll tell you how a little water bottle that was lost in the North Cascades went on a journey to Japan and ended up back in Seattle. As Todd Herrick was just saying, nature can sometimes be an unexpected cast member during performances at the Kitsap Forest Theater. Well, across the Puget Sound, about an hour's drive from Seattle, the forest is playing the role of a healer. The internet and video games, some people, they can't pull themselves away. In places like China and South Korea, addictions to the digital world are viewed as a public health threat that's capable of ruining lives. In these countries, there are lots of digital detox centers where people can get help. But here in the United States, just two or three of these places exist. And by the way, the professional world of psychology in the U.S. doesn't yet consider someone being glued to his or her digital device 24/7 as an official addiction. So one of these centers in the U.S. happens to be in Falls City, Washington. 88.5's Will James tells us that the heart of the treatment involves leaving the modern world behind.
I'm in a sun-filled house that backs up against the woods of Falls City, about midway between Seattle and the Cascade Mountains. Right away, little clues tell me this isn't a typical suburban home.
There's a typewriter here. I don't know how many years it's been since I've seen a typewriter. Have you used this?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have our computers, phones, all of that we give to the staff here and we don't keep with us.
The two guys giving me a tour of this house are enrolled in a detox and recovery program for internet and video game addicts called Restart. People come here from all over the country. They spend 7 weeks without so much as looking at a computer screen.
Here's a relic here. There's a print newspaper on one of the beds.
These guys are in their early 20s, and they're trying to fill this enormous hole that technology occupied in their lives.
So this is our music room. Obviously, you know, because a lot of us being internet addicts, you know, you lost a lot of what you did, so we're trying to, point of this is to develop new things to do, and also just, because music is a great tool, so, you know, we have our piano, guitar.
They lead me into the backyard, where they spend a lot of their time practicing frisbee golf and learning wilderness skills. Way in the back, behind a garden and a burbling stream, is a trail that leads into the woods and to the door of a one-room cottage. This is where residents of the house have group therapy sessions and have some of their most vulnerable talks about what led them to this place.
We do our ITAA meetings here also, Internet and Technology Addicts Anonymous, so.
My two tour guides sit down and begin to explain what it means to be a technology addict. They ask for anonymity so they can speak openly about stories they consider very private.
I grew up born and raised in Southern California. Both my parents are immigrants from Southeast Asia. So I grew up with a lot of cultural expectations, being the only boy, being the youngest child. I've always failed to meet them, and I grew up with a lot of depression and isolation and loneliness. So I took that out by either fighting with my parents and rebelling against them and playing video games.
Games were a refuge, and the more things in his life went wrong, like when he failed out of college, the more irresistible that refuge became.
I even skipped, showers. I even skipped meals. I would go a day where I had a bowl of cereal at, 4 p.m., because that's when I would wake up, and just play games until 4 a.m. that night, and just go to sleep.
Part of the definition of addiction is engaging in the behavior in spite of its negative consequences.
Hillary Cash is a psychologist who helped found the Restart program in 2009. We spoke up on the house's porch. She has the gentle manner of a therapist, but this no-nonsense quality as well. For more than 20 years, she's been on a crusade to convince others in her field that this addiction is real. American psychology only officially recognizes one so-called behavioral addiction, gambling. But Cash says the internet isn't so different. Like gambling, it's based on a principle called the unpredictability of reward. Decades ago, the psychologist B.F. Skinner found he could get a pigeon to press a bar for food almost endlessly, as long as that reward came just unpredictably enough.
He could keep that bird pecking till it dropped, kind of thing. And that principle is the foundation of gambling. It's also the foundation of games. And it is also what's at work in almost everything we do online. All right, you open up your email. You don't know if you're going to find anything of interest, or will it be all this stuff that you just are swamped by that you don't really want to bother with. But even in a day's worth of email, there are going to be some nuggets there. Some nuggets of emails that you want to get, that you're interested in, that reward you. Okay? So that keeps you going back to email.
When I feel a little pang of anxiety or a moment of boredom, I find myself, without even thinking about it, kind of glancing at my phone, looking to see if someone on Twitter has interacted with me or something. That strikes me as somewhat addictive in nature, and it also strikes me as really, really common. Are we all technology addicted in some sense?
Well, of course we're not all technology addicted, but I do think that, I think the vast majority of people are pulled in this way that is certainly pulling them toward an addiction. It might be very mild, or it could be quite severe.
This constant stimulation rewires us. Part of the treatment here is just being bored, getting to that daydreamy place where you pick up a random book or just think for a while. Cash says it's like we're in the early days of the car, before the invention of seatbelts or traffic lights. The internet has spread to every corner of our lives, but psychologists are just starting to understand how it changes human behavior.
It feels like there is a growing number of us, which is good, but that we are pushing against a tide that is really just overwhelming all of us. And it's this tide of technological advance.
So how do you thrust an internet addict back into this world, a world aglow with smartphones and computer screens? Cash and the other founders of Restart quickly realized they needed a place for transition. That place is a cluster of apartments in Redmond. It functions like a halfway house where people who detoxed from technology begin incorporating it back into their lives.
We have some motivational posters on the wall.
Max Grosshandler has lived here for a couple months. He calls his addiction info-gathering or infomania. He would watch YouTube videos for 8 hours a day, absorbing knowledge about whatever topic he was engrossed in at the moment.
Going from as far as comics to the other end of just anything scientifically related.
Can you give me some examples of some stuff that you became really captured by?
Well, I've always been interested by chemical reactions and the way that things form together, like how you can make something levitate by supercooling a superconductor.
So he was learning stuff, but he was watching so much YouTube it was threatening to derail his college career. Here in Redmond, he shares this apartment with a couple other guys at a time. The place looks like a college dormitory suite, but once again, there's a conspicuous absence of screens. Max is allowed to use a cell phone, but only an old-fashioned flip phone.
How old are you, if I might ask?
I am 19 years of age.
Had you ever used or seen a phone like this before?
In fact, actually, yeah.
The flip phone means he's out of the woods, living among us, but at the same time, apart from us. He works at an office supply store and works through his breaks because everyone else is on their smartphones. He's discovered swing dancing, but hearing him talk about getting to his lessons makes you appreciate how convenient our smartphones really are.
Yeah, there's a third-party service that I use called GoGo Grandparent, which is basically Uber for flip phones. I got bus schedules. It would be much more convenient to use the application, but since I don't have that, I have to rely on good old-fashioned pen and paper.
Soon, that will change. When I talk to him, he's preparing to get his smartphone back. For someone whose computer use fell out of control, that is a scary prospect.
In fact, I actually am going to have YouTube disabled especially for at least the first few weeks or months, because that I know that is a black hole that if I get anywhere close to, it'll probably be something I can't get back out of. Some people have lost a lot more than I have, who have failed out of college multiple times, who have like lost their house, lost their job, and lost a lot of money. But some people say that I might not be able to fully embrace recovery because I haven't actually hit enough of a deep point yet. And so I'm a little bit scared about that.
His only hope is to develop a healthy relationship with technology, the way someone with an eating disorder seeks a healthy relationship with food. You can't avoid it. You have to learn to live with it. After all, you can't stay in the woods forever.
That was 88.5's Will James. A few months ago, Restart opened an adolescent center near Monroe that treats kids as young as 13. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, in for Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories about heading into the woods. And this next story, the woods is the unknown. It's the thing we're trying to figure out.
To continue the metaphor, if you go for a walk in the woods, you're looking for a trail, you're looking for a path through, you're looking for something that makes you understand that there's a beginning, middle, and end, and there's a point to all of it.
Nigel Jaquis is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist at the Willamette Week in Portland. He spent his career exploring the woods of journalism, mapping out complicated issues for others to understand. But the job is not without hazards.
We get lost all the time as reporters. Sometimes you go down paths that are dead ends. Sometimes you go down a path that might lead you to the equivalent of a cliff or to a scary monster.
Nigel lives in southeast Portland along a quiet road called Oak Street. And about 6 months ago, a brand new news outlet sprung up just a few blocks from his house, a bevy of young reporters also charging into the woods. Kian McCune, Anmol Patel, and Sita Neiman. They're going at top speed.
It's a tough time for newspapers. What made you want to start this now?
Mm-hmm. You're going to laugh so hard at this. But, you know, I used to watch the Andy Griffith Show. And so there's this one episode where, like, they make a newspaper. And I'm like, hey.
Hi, Paul. Want a newspaper?
Well, thanks. I got one.
I mean this one. Howie and I put one out on the print machine he got for his birthday.
Well, your own news sheet, huh? Got any hot scoops?
Yeah, and I started, like, coming up with ideas. Like, what the layout would be. And then I took it to Anmol and Sita, and they're like, great, this is going to be cool.
Okay, hi, my name is Anmol, and I'm in sixth grade, and I...
Like the color yellow?
Yeah, I like the yellow. Color yellow.
My name is Sita, and I am in first grade, and I have an imaginary friend.
Hi, my name is Kim McCune, and I'm in sixth grade, and I like to write. It's the Oak Street Porter, is the newspaper, and so it's super hyper-local, you know? Like, just our street.
Breaking news!
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Get all your news in the Oak Street Reporter.
Well, we all do the reporting, but I kind of started out as the top reporter, so.
All right, what are you most passionate about when you're looking for stories, new stories to cover?
What does that mean?
What do you get excited about? What kind of stories do you want to do?
Well, I kind of look forward to finding out more about people and kind of mystery, so that's kind of what I like to do. Mysterious Tracks by Sita Neiman. Mysterious tracks appeared in the snow in Anmol and Sita's front yard. The tracks were leading into some bushes. When it snows, who knows what's walking around.
We've had two editors of this paper. Anmol was editor for the first two, and he kind of resigned a little bit, but
resigned a little bit. How does that work?
I mean, he resigned, but because he's like, maybe I think you would be a better me, as in he's referring to me, and like you would be a better editor, and I kind of manage the control better a little bit. I'm not like a control freak, like a micromanaging every little thing. I just make sure everything gets done.
Anmol, why did you decide to step down from your position as the editor?
Well, I didn't really know what to like do.
He didn't really know what to do, and so he was mostly just doing normal stuff, and I don't even know what that means. So.
We kind of do news, but we also do a lot of other stuff. Like, Amal did a big two-part racial and social justice column, and that was super cool.
People should be welcome here in Portland, right? Well, I think so. I also think that everybody should be treated fairly. I'm worried that somebody might be coming to Portland. I am worried that they would be mean to people, and that is not right at all.
And then we did my environmental inquiry column. I would say, oh, here's what's happening, like, about the environment and the environment of Oak Street, you know? Is Oak Street as nice as it could be? By Gian W. McEwen. Oak Street takes pride in the fact that it has lots of trees and plants. All the property owners feel this way about Oak Street. Right now, some property owners are thinking I'm misinterpreting them, because sometimes, and believe me, I know, Oak Street feels like a junkyard. It feels dirty and muddy, especially this time of year when the trees are bare and the leaves are clogging up the storm drains on the corner. Some people ask, well, Kian, you're telling me so much about the environment on Oak Street, but what can I do about it? Well, boy, I do. I have some news for you. What you can do is clean out the storm drains, rake the leaves on the... And then our top story was like, Bianca, our neighbor over there, was just moving in, so we were wanted to cover that. And so, we and later in the fourth issue, we did an interview. We did an interview with her.
Did I get interviewed? I think they just wrote a story about me. About my arrival to the hood. New face on Oak Street. Oak Street says, so, goodbye today.
What did they say in it?
That Bianca, Shauna's friend, is moving in after Dave, beloved Dave, left. As everyone knows, there are a lot of kids on Oak Street, and this is big news for everybody. And remember, folks, you heard it here first.
What else, what other stories have really caught your attention in the latest issues?
Well, the most notable is the controversial dirt pile story.
And you're shoveling this dirt right now. Could you tell me what was the controversy there? What happened?
Well, Wendy, my next door neighbor, also who's working hard in the garden, and these gals across the street moved the dirt here. They purchased the dirt and they moved it here so we could put it in the garden, as you can see we're doing right now. There was a little bit of misinformation as to whether or not this dirt was up for grabs, what the content of the dirt was, and its purposes.
Oh, Pile Dirt by Anmol Espadel. Hi everyone, it is Anmol. I have some news. There is a pile of nice fresh dirt near Shauna's house. If you want any, then you can come over. Also, you can use it to put on your old soil that got messed up a long time ago, or you could make a dirt pile for neighborhood kids and pets to jump in.
You don't want to be jumping around in that. It's a little bit dirtier than just dirt, you know what I mean?
Go on.
Some manure in there, in the mix.
So Wendy sent us a letter.
She did. Said urgent, please make a correction. That dirt is not for the whole neighborhood until I've used up as much as I can here and in my yard.
How did the newspaper respond to that letter?
Very swiftly, very promptly. By the next evening, there was a great retraction and apology.
Special thanks to Wendy for her letter to the editor informing us that most of our information about the pile of dirt was wrong. We are lucky to live someplace where our neighbors read our newspaper and allow us to correct our mistakes.
Do you think that it hurt your reputation in the neighborhood at all?
Not really. I would say since we released a correction almost immediately, I don't think so. And to be honest, I mean, the dirt pile would have been a helpful thing to the community, but not a lot of people would care so much. Like, if we received misinformation on such a big issue, say, like, in the Science and the Arts column or something, they would be like, what? And so, you know, but this was just a minor thing. And so I don't think it hurt our reputation at all. But maybe a little bit, but we definitely have repaired that since then.
What sorts of other news sources do the two of you consume?
All kinds.
How would you say the Oak Street Reporter fits into that mix?
Have some local news, get it away from the White House and into the greenhouse.
Your house is green.
Hyper-local news.
That's what we're after.
That story was produced by Phoebe Flanagan. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is taking us into the woods. David Schumer grew up in the suburbs of Detroit in an upper-middle-class Jewish family. He spent his life trying to escape the suburbs. And at 24 years old, this young man from the city, without any knowledge of how to live off the land, retreated into the woods of northern Arkansas, the Ozarks. He wasn't alone. Other out-of-the-box thinkers and long-haired hippies were doing the same thing. And even though David Schumer was looking to nature to test himself, the modern world continued to tap on his shoulder, requesting his attention. David spoke with Sound Effect producer Ali Ferguson about this time in his life in the mid-1970s. David felt like things were not going very well for America.
So Nixon had resigned.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Jimmy Carter was kind of hapless.
It is a crisis of confidence.
The Black Panthers were being decimated.
Police and Black Panthers clash in Houston, New Orleans, and other cities.
A lot of the politics of the new left were kind of falling apart. And disco was starting. You know, if that isn't the sign of an end of a civilization, I don't know what is. I mean, disco? This was bad stuff for us.
And what was your response to this craziness of disco and Jimmy Carter?
Well, I did have some good moves, and I did have a leisure suit. I don't want you to think I was that out of it, Allie. But the main thing was that a lot of us felt that the country was going to fall apart. We didn't think it would be able to sustain itself. So we thought the only sane thing to do would be to move to a rural area, buy 30 acres of land, build a house, and grow our own food.
And who's we?
So there wasn't any group, there wasn't any membership, but we formed what was called the Back to the Land movement. A lot of people throughout the country who were, you know, 60s radicals or 60s active people ended up doing that.
And so you end up moving to rural Arkansas. How did you find this land?
This big piece of land came up for sale at once, and it was in the community of Chimes. So Chimes is about an hour and a half northwest of Little Rock, and it's deep in the Ozark Mountains. And this guy, this realtor, divided this big estate into 20-acre pieces. And many of us came from around the country, and Some were families, some were single, some were married couples.
And so you head down to Arkansas to your 30 acres. What was your plan for the land down there?
What was my plan? Well, I didn't know anything about farming or building or anything. I mean, it was so odd for me to be down there because everything was just new. In fact, I was walking with a realtor, a very folksy realtor named Fairfax Abraham, and I pointed to something on the ground where there are bugs coming out of it. I said, wow, this is where the ants live. And he said, I got to put you down for that, buddy. I ain't never seen someone who ain't seen cow before. But I didn't. I mean, I knew nothing about it.
So was it enjoyable? I mean, what did you like about being down there?
You were so removed from every other distraction. I mean, if someone asked me what is my favorite memory of my life, I would think about one night in when I was sitting on my porch in Arkansas, and you could see fireflies throughout the whole wood. And I mean, and they lit up the whole wood, and I was sitting by myself just staring at the fireflies for hours. You know, I mean, those were the type of experiences we would have quite often.
So you had those moments of sitting on the porch watching the fireflies for hours, which sound absolutely beautiful, but well, there's got to be the other side of that. It's hard.
It was very hard. Whenever my neighbor would come over, and his name was Johnny Reeves, I learned he was about to save me from a disaster. So he came over once, and he looked at this foundation I was building on my house. And he said to me, he said, Dave, a feller might want to put the bigger rocks on the bottom. And I thought to myself, huh, I wonder what he means by that. And then the next day, the whole foundation just, you know, just had fallen down overnight. And then I began to get it. You know, I thought they were just being polite or making small talk. I translated in my mind is that a feller might, is that a very stupid person will not listen to this piece of advice.
So you're out in the Ozarks, you know, you're living off the grid, but there's something that draws you back to political reality in 1979. What is that?
So we had a rule in our community. You could not have electricity. So we were pretty strict that we didn't want to have anything to do with the bigger America as a whole. And then when Three Mile Island melted down.
There was an accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, which is located on an island in the Susquehanna River, 10 miles from Harrisburg. A cooling pump broke down, and the plant did just what it was supposed to do, shut itself off. But not before some radioactivity had escaped.
We all realized that we were just, 25, 30 miles away from a nuclear power plant in Russellville, Arkansas. And if that melted down, our land would be unusable, our houses would be unusable, we would have to be evacuated. We, as well as the rest of the country after Three Mile Island, wanted to shut down all the nuclear power plants in the country.
And what did you do?
So there was this day in November, I think it was, and the group was called the Clamshell Alliance. People who were anti-nuclear in Arkansas were going to drive down to the Russellville nuclear power plant and trespass on it, get arrested, make a big deal, and try to shut the thing down. They were going to do this all over the country.
What happened?
Well, we got down there, about six of us from our neighborhood, and there was this guy, this really cool-looking older hippie, you know, and he said, well, I don't think we should commit, you know, nonviolent disobedience. He thought we should just hold signs. And then John Foley, who was this, you know, who was one of my neighbors, and he said, and then he said, you guys are a bunch of wussies. He said, you know, if the six of us have to shut down this plant ourselves, the six of us will. And with that, you know, the whole crowd turned by there. They're just waiting for some crazy hipsters from the woods to just kind of march in and take over. And we just marched and we marched in and you know, and I broke through first, and that's how I became the first person ever to be arrested for trespassing a nuclear power plant in Arkansas. And I got on the front page of the Arkansas Gazette. You know, that was it. So
did you shut down the plant at all?
Well, I don't think anyone shut down the plant, but what happened in this country after the protests, there became such agreement that nuclear power was a bad idea that for the next 37 years, there was not a new nuclear power plant that opened up in the country. And even now, with the one they opened this year, it's very hard to get support for a nuclear power plant.
How did this change your vision of this peaceful rural life off the grid? How did this experience maybe put some cracks in that idea?
Well, you know, I think you can never get far enough away. You know, we tried to bury our heads in the sand. You know, one, things can never get that bad that you shouldn't have a voice in it. I thought the seven of us and the rest of us, the rest of the people in the anti-nuke movement, you know, had a strong voice and really changed things.
So looking back all these years later, was it worth it to move to Arkansas and live off the grid?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think Arkansas formed me as an individual. If ever I doubted that there was something I couldn't do, if ever I doubted that I didn't have the capability to learn, having that experience down there where you had to learn so much, and if you didn't put your roof on right, it would leak. And if it leaked, you had to take it off and put it back on. That kind of coming up against reality for me, you know, day in and day out, really formed me as a human being. And, you know, made me realize that I could be competent. But also when you have comfort in your skills, you can be compassionate. When you're not worried all the time about how you're doing or if you're going to succeed or fail, you can look around and see other people who need help. Everything in the woods is done gradually, just like ants, just done piece by piece. And when you realize that anything, medical school is actually done piece by piece, raising your kids, all that stuff. And you realize that if you can keep on that piece by piece mentality, you can find incredible freedom in your life.
That was David Schumer talking with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson. These days, David is still living in the woods, sort of. He's a primary care doctor in Enumclaw, Washington. For our last story on the show today, we go back to August of 2003. Four men, friends from different parts of the U.S., met at a trailhead in the North Cascades to spend a long weekend together camping in the backcountry. One of the guys in the group, George Wing, was getting married in a few days. To me. This was his bachelor outing. And on this trip, he lost a small plastic water bottle. He thought he'd never see it again. And just a heads up, this story goes into some things that might be a little inappropriate for young ears. So it was George Wing, his friend Mark, another George named George Wolf, and their friend Kermit. Yes, that is his real name.
It's true. His name is Kermit. And very shortly after that, the Muppets show was produced, and he was very annoyed because people made fun of him. And he wrote a letter, actually, to Jim Henson saying, "You ruined my life. People make fun of me," and Jim Henson sent him a mug. He still has the mug.
That's George Wing. And joining us on the phone from Los Angeles is another person from that 2003 bachelor trip, George Wolf. George Wolf has also known Kermit for a long time and says Kermit is a natural when it comes to pulling pranks.
He was always inclined to do something that kind of pushed the envelope of acceptability. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Well, he hired someone to mug you in New York City with a real gun. So that's
on my birthday. Yeah.
When this group went backpacking, they brought all of the necessities for such a trip: tents, food, a first aid kit. But Kermit, he decided to shake things up a bit.
I mean, as you recall, it was supposed to be a very wholesome bachelor party. You know, no drugs, no strippers. And
right.
Then we set up our first camp, and I hear music, and there's this female leg protruding from Kermit's tent, dancing in the air, but not really human, sort of too small and weirdly deformed. And that was my first glimpse of Claudine.
Claudine was a life-size, cheap, plastic, inflatable sex doll. Her skin was the texture of a pool toy that you'd buy in the spring with the expectation that it would only last one summer. No one seems to remember why they named the doll Claudine, but that's who she became.
It was too much of a pain to deflate her for our hike the next day, so we just strapped her to my pack with her arms and very wide spread.
You were piggybacking her.
Yes, with her like spread legs flopping in the breeze. And
I think we might have given her like a plaid shirt, or did I just imagine that or make that up?
No, that's ringing a bell. We might have, just for modesty's sake, put some clothes on her.
I mean, on the one hand, we have to say it wasn't, the spirit of it wasn't crude. I mean, okay, so she's a sex doll. But in everything that I could think of, whether we were at the lake or hiking or by the campfire or whatnot, she was just kind of one of the guys. She was hanging out, you know, around the campfire. We had to make sure not to get her too close because she would implode, right?
So we were vaguely aware of having scandalized some other people who were camped at that lake, but we didn't pay too much attention to them. You went off on a long hike by yourself to some distant mountain, and mm-hmm. I became worried about you, knowing that you didn't have food or water with you and it was getting late in the day. So I took my little plastic water bottle and filled it with water and set off to find you, and I didn't find you. I went several miles up a trail, and I finally just put the bottle down in the middle of the trail with a note on it that said, "For George Wolf." And the only piece of paper I have is my wilderness hiking permit. So I used that. I went back to camp. You weren't there. Just as dusk was falling and we were playing in the lake with Claudine, you reappeared, a little bloody and scratched up from a completely different direction. And you were back, but you had not found the water bottle. And I figured I would never see it again. And you know, who cares? It's just a cheap plastic REI half-size Nalgene bottle, right?
The weekend continued under blue skies and warm summer breezes. Claudine was a faithful companion who served as a flotation device when the men were swimming naked in the Alpine Lake. Everyone made it out of the woods safe and sound. And then life got really busy. We got married, we moved house a few times, we had our kids, Lucy and Henry. 7 years quickly ticked by from that weekend in the woods with Claudine and the lost water bottle. Then one day, this small box from Japan landed on our front porch. It was addressed to George Wing.
And on the little Japanese customs slip, it said, "Prestic Botole," spelled wrong. And I opened it up, and there was a water bottle, and I instantly knew it was that water bottle because the piece of paper that I had written on was my wilderness hiking permit. It didn't even have my address on it. It just had my name. And along with the bottle was this absolutely gorgeous letter written entirely in Japanese characters. And I couldn't understand a word of it, but my brain exploded. How did this happen?
Yeah, why this water bottle in a box from Japan 7 years later? And the timing was interesting because we were about to send Lucy off to kindergarten to a public Japanese immersion school.
Which turned out to be useful because we found someone who could interpret the letter for us.
Yes.
I'm Riezeli. I teach second, third grade Japanese at John Stanford International School.
Rie is holding a black and white photocopy of this letter. The original is a beautiful watercolor painting with these delicate brushstrokes.
Oh, it's so artistic. Really, really, yeah. Unbelievable. Okay, so should I start?
Yeah.
George Wing-sama. 突然のお手紙ごめんなさい。 そして英語で書けずごめんなさい。 I'm not going to talk about what was happening. What was happening? The very fun time you guys are having at the lake.
And that's when I understood. Oh, they saw us swimming naked in the lake with Claudine. I wouldn't have approached me either. Nope.
And also, this wasn't really the appropriate place for the two Japanese girls to go to. It's the party, I think she's saying. And so she somehow ended up bringing the bottle back to Japan. Then finally, she decided to use the internet to see if she could find George Wing, and I hope you are the right person and this bottle will go back to the original owner. Sincerely, from Japan.
Who sent this package?
Karin Nakagawa. And she turns out to be a pretty amazing musician. She's one of the few people who can play the 25-string Koto Japanese harp.
This massive instrument. Yeah, it's huge.
And she sings. And so she's kind of a rock star in Europe.
When that package arrived at our house, and we opened it up, and we recognized this object that used to be in our life that we really didn't give a second thought to, right? When all of that was flooding through my brain and your brain, how did it make you feel about interactions that we have with people that we don't even know we're having? It made me trust people more.
I got a slightly different feeling from it. It was more like a little magic moment, and that was out there all those years and came back to me. So there may be other things in my life that come back to me, or that where the circle is finally closed way, way after you think it possibly could be.
Yeah, when you least expect it. We did eventually get in touch with Karin Nakagawa and sent her our own package. Inside was a thank you note and some really good chocolate from Seattle. The journey that small plastic water bottle took elevated its value in our home. It's now preciously guarded. It represents the moments of serendipity and magic floating around in this world. Since the bottle's return to Seattle, it's made lots of trips back into the deep woods. It's been filled with ripe blackberries and huckleberries, coffee, and of course, lots of water. Last year, that bottle headed back to Japan. Lucy went there on a trip with her class, and George was one of the chaperones, and that long-lived, well-traveled piece of plastic was tucked away in his backpack. George and Lucy would have loved to have met up with Karin Nakagawa, but she was on tour with her harp. And that does it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Allie Ferguson, Kyle Norris, Phoebe Flanagan, Will James, and Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom helps with photos and videos, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. If you missed a part of the show or any other episode of Sound Effect, do not worry. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, where you can get all 133 episodes that we've aired so far. And you can also rate and review the show there, which is a really big help to us. And you can also hear our stories on the NPR One app and see photos, videos, and other extras on our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer returns next week when Sound Effect explores the opioid crisis in our region. I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.